From GPB News, this is On Second Thought. I'm Celeste Headley. Do you remember your first time?
I feel like somebody who wants to be president should recognize the issues that America has, recognize that they are human and that they're going to make mistakes, and just somebody who like looks at the underdogs and is like, okay, they need help in this community.
Voices of some of Georgia's first-time voters today will also give a standing ovation to The Masquerade, which has served Atlanta's music scene for 26 years. We asked for your memories of The Masquerade on Reddit, and here are your first thoughts. Seeing Squared says, I was in a punk band around 2008 or so, and it snowed on the night of our show. The crowd was really thin due to the weather. Masquerade wound up condensing the crowd and throwing us in with a bunch of metal bands, which we didn't feel great about, but it wound up being freaking awesome. We screamed a bunch more than usual, and the crowd was going crazy. And a Reddit user named Spooky Farts says, my first concert ever was there. It was Weird Al Yankovic around 92 or so. I got kicked out for trading somebody a cigarette for a beer. I also remember the good old days of hustling tickets to friends when my band used to play there. All in all, it's kind of a crap venue that manages to get a lot of good shows. We always love to know what you think. You can call us with your stories at 404-500-9457. We're also on Twitter at OST Talk, or just post to Facebook and we might feature your comments on the show. Well, it may not feel like the 1st of November to many people. Georgia is in the middle of a serious drought. 90-degree days and a lack of rainfall have affected areas around the state. The National Drought Monitor Center has found that more than 50 Georgia counties are currently in extreme drought, and that's led to severe water restrictions for some places. Here to tell us more about the drought is Jack Kapp. He's the chief of the Environmental Protection Division Watershed Protection Branch. Hi, Jack.
Good morning.
And also with us is Jonathan Erdman. He's a senior meteorologist with the Weather Channel. Good morning, Jonathan.
Good morning, Celeste. Nice to be here.
It's good to have you. So I wanted to dig a little deeper into these designations. Like, extreme is the second worst designation, right, Jack? The top is exceptional?
That's right. Now, that's the United States Drought Monitor that does that, and that's certainly one of the indicators that we track in our state.
But the state of Georgia gets to decide how bad a drought is in terms of measures that need to be taken. Is that correct?
Right. So what we're doing is, you know, we track the climatic conditions that are present, and then we have response levels that we can initiate under our rulemaking authority to impose restrictions. So we certainly aren't saying there is or isn't a drought. That's scientific information that other folks present. We look to see what we can and should do in order to protect our public water supplies.
So, Jonathan, what does it mean really to be in a drought? I mean, is that a certain number of days without rain?
Well, Celeste, this is pretty amazing for this time of year. Basically, we've seen parts of Alabama and Georgia go 3 weeks or more without a single drop of rain. Which, if you think about it, you know, the Gulf of Mexico is what, just a half-day drive away. The Atlantic Ocean is a half-day drive away. How on earth can we go this long without this much precipitation? So generally, a drought is two different measures. One can be kind of a short-term drought, what we call a flash drought, and it's just based on rainfall. And then there's long-term droughts, what we have particularly in California, where the water supply has been so deprived of rain and snowmelt for so long that the water supply remains low, even though precipitation has recently been there over the last month or so. So there's two types of droughts. This one is really been a flash drought, but now just due to the severity of it, it's becoming more of a long-term concern.
What is triggered, Jack, when you find out that an area of Georgia is in drought? Are there official mechanisms that then go into place? Is that when you start saying, don't wash your clothes at 2 p.m. in the afternoon?
Yeah, so the first thing that we do is we track all of these climatic indicators and see how it's impacting public water supplies. And we do that by monitoring those conditions as well as having communications with our public water systems. As was mentioned, because we've had such a lack of rain, we actually imposed a drought response level one almost 2 months ago based on the conditions in 53 counties in northwest Georgia. That required all of those public water systems to engage in a public information campaign to all of their customers using a variety of media to educate them on the situation that we're in terms of drought and to encourage them to reduce water usage. The next level would be imposing additional water restrictions, we are actively talking about that in the agency as to whether or not we need to increase the drought response level to impose additional restrictions.
If you're just joining us, my guests are Jack Kapp from the Environmental Protection Division and the Weather Channel's Jonathan Erdman. We're talking about the ongoing drought in Georgia, and we wonder if you're feeling it. Are there water restrictions in place where you live? Let us know. You can tweet us now at OSD Talk. Jonathan, how did we get here? Is there a larger weather system similar to what most people know of as El Nino that sort of caused this drought?
Well, Celeste, it's interesting because really we're coming off of a year which was actually quite wet over much of Georgia in 2015, and that was due in part to a record-tying El Nino last year. Now what we're seeing, though, and it's really kicked in over the summertime, is just these massive precipitation deficits across the Southeast and the Tennessee Valley, particularly North Georgia, Alabama, and the Western Carolinas. And that is due in large part to the jet stream typically moves farther to the north in the summer. So in the summertime, you're pretty well restricted to just clusters of thunderstorms that occasionally can soak your yard, but maybe a mile away, your friend's yard may not get soaked at all, those typical isolated thunderstorms. And then it's quite stunning to me that if you take a drive to the Eastern Carolinas or even down to Savannah or St. Simons, they've had two tropical cyclones. They had Hurricane Hermine hit landfall in Florida and then move up into the Carolinas. And then, of course, recently Hurricane Matthew. So they, of course, have been very, very wet. So you just have this staggering precipitation contrast from the Eastern Carolinas to, unfortunately, the extreme to exceptional drought that we have now in the Southeast.
So, Jack, we spoke with agricultural climatologist Pam Knox back in August, and she was talking about the weather conditions in North Georgia as well. Take a listen.
The northwest part of the state was the first part to go into drought, and they've had some tremendous problems because the dry spell hit right when the corn was supposed to be pollinating, and pollination requires a certain amount of moisture, and a lot of the corn crops just didn't really set any kernels in their ears this year, so the farmers have lost most of the corn crop there, whereas in other parts of the state, the timing was a little bit better.
So, Jack, I realize you're with watershed protection, but at what point does the state have to start thinking about managing damages from what has become kind of an ongoing drought?
Well, certainly we've seen, impacts to the dry weather agricultural use. You know, a lot of the agricultural use that we have in our state is irrigated acreage. And so that's one of the reasons why Georgia is such a tremendous agricultural state. As we've got the southwest part of the state that has a great resources for water, and they irrigate their crops. And so they're not as impacted by this kind of situation. What we're focused on in the rulemaking that we authority that we have in statute from our legislature is protecting those public water supplies.
And where the irrigation comes from, you mean? Where is the irrigated water coming from?
No, irrigation would typically come from farmers that have their own wells or ponds or withdrawals from surface water.
And we're not yet at the place where the drought is affecting those levels of the water table or the ponds?
We're in situations where a lot of those folks still have good productivity from their wells. Again, most of our agricultural use is in the southern part of the state that isn't quite as impacted as the northwest part of the state.
So, Jonathan, what are we to expect? I mean, how unnormal, how unaverage are our high temperatures at this point and the precipitation or lack thereof?
Well, we'll start out with the temperatures, and I had been meaning to almost ask our Georgia audience, are there any swimming pools still open in the Atlanta area? Because this is truly incredible to start out November with highs in the upper 80s in North Georgia and also pushing some 90s in the deep south. That's setting some all-time November record highs. So just the persistence of this is something that we typically see in droughts. You know, once the drought, once the ground gets dried out, it's just a feedback mechanism. The air becomes a few degrees hotter because you're not having to evaporate moisture from the soil. There's just no moisture there. So the ground heats up more, heats up faster. So what we're seeing the temperature-wise is just shattering records across much of the south, and we've seen that over the last several days. Now, as far as precipitation...
Wait, before we moved on to some precipitation, do we know when a break in those temperatures might come?
Well, we're going to take the top off of those temperatures later this week, fortunately. So, you know, we'll see temperatures recover, maybe still say in the 70s and 80s, but certainly nothing like upper 80s to near 90 that we've
but
seen.
But 70s and 80s
days.
Is still exceptional for November, isn't it? Is it not?
It's still warm. We should be starting to talk more as the month goes on, talking about 60s, maybe some 70s eventually instead of these 80s. You know, the 80s eventually gets pushed down to Florida. So, yes,
okay.
this is quite unusual.
All right, let's move on to precipitation then.
Well, in the short term, and by short term, I mean in the next week or so, we don't see a whole lot of relief, unfortunately. What we really need is a pattern where we really tap that Gulf of Mexico moisture and just pump it into the southeast. And there's really nothing, you know, looming on the horizon for the next week or so. And one small concern going into the winter is that we are headed toward the opposite of El Nino, which is called La Nina, which is a cooling of the equatorial Pacific waters in the eastern Pacific. What that really means as one potential driver of this, the atmospheric circulation, is that we tend to trend drier than average over the winter months in the southeast rather than wetter. So it's almost, in some ways, it's almost the polar opposite of El Nino. So that's not terribly good news, but again, that's only one driver of the atmosphere. So we'll see how the winter and spring months you know, treat as far as precipitation is concerned in the southeast.
So, Jack, in the minute or so that we have left, give us some advice on things that we can do that maybe aren't quite too painful but could help.
Yeah, no, that's a great question. And so, you know, in a nutshell, things that you know, you and I and your listeners can do around our home is checking for and repairing for leaks that are either inside or outside the house. A really simple thing is just don't leave those taps running. You know, turn off that tap when you're not using it. You know, brushing your teeth, shaving, all of those kind of activities, rinsing your food off. You know, turn that tap on, you know, do what you need to do, and then turn it off right away. We're getting near the end of that green lawn season for those folks that really like having that really lush lawn. That grass is normally going to go dormant over the winter, and we're at that phase. So think about turning it off, or at the very least, go out there and see what you're sprinkling.
Yeah.
And if you're sprinkling your road, you don't need to do that. And you need to get those things tuned up. But we're at that at that time of year where, you know, it's all right if you stop irrigating that lawn, it's going to go dormant.
Jack Kapp is the chief of the Watershed Protection Branch in Georgia, and Jonathan Erdman is senior meteorologist for the Weather Channel. Thanks so much to both of you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
A landmark in Midtown Atlanta will shut its doors this weekend. The Masquerade has been at its current location on North Avenue since 1990. Before that, it was an operational mill called the Dupree Excelsior Mill. But over the years, its reputation as a grungy eyesore grew.
Objectively speaking, that parking lot that was full of broken glass, used condoms, dirty needles, like the park that is there right now is objectively better than that. There was a guy that would always like hang out in the parking lot and he would be like, "Hey, I'll watch your car for $5, which meant that for $5, he wouldn't break into your car.
That's Barbara Tushbant. She worked as a waitress at the Masquerade and says she's actually sad to see it close. Developers purchased the building for about $60 million and plan to create a mixed-use development. The Masquerade announced earlier this year it'll move to a new home on the west side of Atlanta. And that news came as a disappointment to a huge number of music lovers like Eric Brown.
The Masquerade's been there for forever. I think they should leave it where it is because it's really an Atlantic music treasure. And I mean, back in the 90s, you had The Point, you had Star Bar, you know, so you had a huge music scene here, and always the big acts played at the Masquerade. And now it's kind of, they're just killing it.
One concert goer who only gave her first name as Lori has been going to the Masquerade since the 90s. She says it's more than just the music.
I think one of the sad things about Atlanta is that we tear down a lot of history here. And I kind of look at it as this iconic music place, you know, so it's kind of sad to see it going away. It may not be the prettiest thing, but it's got a lot of history and personality. And I mean, there's tens of thousands of people that have memories of some shape or form from Masquerade.
The Masquerade has been a top venue for bands when they roll into town. Nine Inch Nails and the Foo Fighters have played there. But as this caller points out, it's also nurtured countless local bands from the underground Atlanta scene. Here's Inja Cornwell.
They reach out to local bands. They reach out to the local people, and they support them. And, you know, they throw out these all-out bashes that, you know, these bands never would have gotten their foot in the door until they showed up at the Masquerade.
The Masquerade has been fighting extinction for more than a decade. In 2004, the then-owner wanted to raise the building and build condominiums. Many longtime Atlantans like Barbara Tushpant say rumors of the Masquerade's demise have popped up every year since.
It has been closing since the 90s, and every year people were like, this is the last Halloween of the Masquerade, this is the last New Year's at the Masquerade, and so I would always go, and I would dance all freaking night, and then like the next year they were like, yeah, for real this time, it's going away. So I'm not going to believe it, that it's gone, until it's actually gone.
This time around, the move is real. Legal problems have delayed the venue's relocation to the west side, but the Masquerade will set up a temporary shop at Kenny's Alley in downtown's underground Atlanta. Concerts are slated to begin there next week. If you've ever had a memorable night at the Masquerade in Atlanta, we want to hear about it. Call us at 404-500-9457 and leave us a message, or post your stories to our Facebook page. Let's hear a little archive audio from one of the Masquerade's most famous shows now. Here is Nirvana on stage in Atlanta in 1991. More than a million early ballots have been cast in Georgia so far, and for some, this is the first election in which they're eligible to vote. One of those first-time voters is my 18-year-old son, Grant. He sees it as a civic duty.
I'm just voting. I have to do it to actually make sure the country doesn't destroy itself. Like, people go, well, my vote doesn't matter, but if one person says my vote doesn't matter, and then the next person says it, then the next person says it, and you can't rely on the next person to not say it. So everyone has to vote because you don't know that everyone's going to vote. It's a catch-22.
But some first-time voters we talked to say they've thought about not voting. Many are turned off by the nastiness of the presidential race, like 18-year-old Taylor Stephenson. He's a student at Decatur High School.
For the past few elections, I've been wanting to vote in them, but I was too young, obviously. But now that we have two people that I don't really agree with on either side, it feels a little awkward for me to vote in this election. I just feel like it's just a back and forth argument between Trump and Clinton. And I personally do not think that's a very healthy relationship for our country.
Stephenson says the biggest election issue on her mind is police brutality.
The way that police officers shoot before they think is not very appropriate, in my opinion. And that the training that they use, they need to go through more training before they become actual on-the-street police officers.
And we have a first-time voter on our team. Our intern, Cree Montague, says she's heard a lot about financial inequality in this presidential race, but she says she hasn't heard the right things from either candidate, particularly not from Donald Trump.
I experienced that firsthand, so it's like living check to check. It's kind of hard. And when you see someone who's a presidential candidate and he doesn't even know probably what $7.50 looks like, he doesn't know what living food stamp to food stamp looks like. He doesn't know how that feels. So it's like you have to vote for someone who doesn't even almost relate to you, who doesn't even almost see a percentage of the life that you live.
Not all new voters are millennials. Some are new to the experience of U.S. citizenship, like Debbie Minto of Atlanta. She became a citizen last year. Debbie moved to the U.S. more than a decade ago from the U.K., but has not been able to vote until now.
If you don't vote, then you can't complain about what you get. Every single vote counts. Even the smallest snowflake doesn't understand that it's part of the avalanche. And you can be that snowflake.
Debbie Minto is undecided, even a week out from the general election. Her touchstone issue? Access to good quality health care.
The problem that I'm having is that I don't like either of the candidates on a personal level. And I'm finding it difficult to align myself with a particular party because each of the parties have something that I'm aligned with, but they also have other things that I'm not.
Are you a first-time voter here in Georgia? We'd love to get your take on this election. Call us at 404-500-9457, or you can reach us on Twitter. It's at OST Talk. Congress passed the Voting Rights Act 51 years ago, so it might surprise you to learn some experts say minority voting rights are just as endangered as ever. One of those experts is Ari Berman. He's a journalist with The Nation, and he's the author of Give Us the Ballot, The Modern Struggle for Voting Rights in America. Ari joined me to discuss his book last year, and I asked why he thinks Americans are in the same position now as they were before the Voting Rights Act passed. He said the answer to that is illustrated by remarks made by former Supreme Court Justice Antonin Scalia. Scalia passed away a few months after I spoke with Ari Berman. Here's a portion of that conversation.
Well, what I'm saying is that we're in a whole new struggle over voting rights, that things have changed dramatically since 1965. We've made an unbelievable amount of progress. We have people like John Lewis in the Congress. We have Barack Obama as president. But what we're also seeing is a new effort to restrict voting rights. We saw a wave of new voting restrictions following the 2010 election. Half the states in the country passed new laws making it harder to vote. Then the Supreme Court gutted the heart of the Voting Rights Act in 2013. And so we've seen new voter suppression measures in places like Texas and North Carolina and Alabama as a result.
Well, let's actually listen to U.S. Supreme Court Justice Antonin Scalia. This was during oral arguments in 2013. It sounds like he was not convinced that there was a need for the law just because Congress had voted to reauthorize the Voting Rights Act multiple times.
I don't think that's attributable to the fact that it is so much clearer now that we need this. I think it is very likely attributable to a phenomenon that is called perpetuation of racial entitlement. It's been written about whenever a society adopts racial entitlements, it is very difficult to get out of them through the normal political processes.
So what did you make of the Supreme Court's decision and why they made that decision?
Well, first off, that was just such an absolutely outrageous statement.
The fact that the Voting Rights Act was a racial entitlement.
By Justice Scalia. We were talking about a situation where only 2% of African Americans could vote in Selma, Alabama before the passage of the Voting Rights Act. Only 6.7% of African Americans could vote in Mississippi before the Voting Rights Act. The Voting Rights Act was not a racial entitlement. It was about, as President Johnson said in the clip you played, racial equality. It was about finally saying, if we are a democracy, we cannot have millions of people disenfranchised in the South. That's not who we are. And so what the Voting Rights Act brought was justice, equality, and fairness. And it brought an entire segment of the population who had been disenfranchised into the political process. Now, I think what Justice Scalia is saying is revealing of the fact that there's been a 50-year effort
right.
to try to roll back the Voting Rights Act and to make it seem not like a landmark civil rights law, but like a racial entitlement. And this has been a project in the conservative movement for many years. And the 2013 Supreme Court decision was really the high point of this conservative backlash to the civil rights movement. What the justices argued, the Chief Justice John Roberts, who wrote the opinion, was that history had changed since 1965.
Right, that we don't need it anymore.
Very dramatically, but the Voting Rights Act had not. And I think what Justice Roberts and the other four conservative justices missed was that, yes, history did not end in 1965, but voter suppression efforts didn't end either.
However, you know, voting rights has not been an absolute in the United States since the days of the founders. Not even the group that we think of as our founding fathers, they didn't believe in absolute voting rights for everyone.
No, there is no fundamental right to vote in this country. In 1787, when the Constitution was ratified, only white male property owners could
right.
vote. And before the voting Voting Rights Act of 1965, millions of people were disenfranchised. So this is something that's been part of our history. We always like to talk about how fundamental the right to vote is.
But that's a modern concept.
We treat it far more as a privilege than a right.
And the other thing that's troubling to me is that the other piece of this is once you give people the right to vote, whether they exercise it or not. That's the other complication, right? Because I'm looking back at the statistics. Turnout in 2000 was 54%. Turnout in 2008 was 62%, which was a high water mark. But 2012, we were back down to 57%. So on the whole, only about half of the country that's eligible to vote actually votes, and voting rights won't change that.
Well, we have a whole lot of people that are disconnected from the political process, but I do think that the laws matter a lot. When you pass laws that make it easier to vote, more people tend to vote. So in laws, for example, that have same-day voter registration, where you can show up, you can register and vote at the same time, those states have voter turnouts up to 10% higher than states that don't. We can't solve all the problems with different laws, but if we make it easier to vote, more people will participate. The problem with restricting voting rights is, as you mentioned, if half the people aren't voting and then you add new voting restrictions, you're going to see even lower turnout and more people disconnected from the political process.
What evidence do we have that this is a political movement, that this has been sort of an effort for half a century to restrict voting rights rather than just people honestly believing the Voting Rights Act is not necessary anymore?
Well, if you look at what happened is so many of the new voting restrictions passed after President Obama's election. And the type of things they did, like cutting early voting, shutting down voter registration drives, requiring strict forms of government-issued ID, those specifically targeted the core of Barack Obama's coalition, particularly voters of color and younger people. And it was an attempt to make the electorate older, whiter, and more conservative, as opposed to younger, more progressive, and more diverse. And you heard Republican politicians say, for example, that voter ID laws were going to help Romney win in Pennsylvania and many other statements. So there is definitely a racial element to this, but a very large partisan element as well. I think voting rights is one of the sleeper issues of the 2016 election that's going to have a huge impact that no one's really talking about.
But you seem to think this is part of a larger effort, and you talk specifically in your book about the backlash against civil rights that began as far back as the 1970s, I mean, within just a few years of the passage of some of this legislation. So what do you mean by that? Do you think that this effort to restrict voting rights is part of this larger backlash?
I think it's both based on the political circumstances of the time, the fact that we have the first black president and rapidly growing demographics that align more strongly with the Democratic Party. But I also think it's part of a 50-year backlash. There have been people that have been trying to challenge the Voting Rights Act from the very beginning, and they've been using different arguments to challenge it. First, they use a states' rights argument. Then they use a racial entitlement argument that you heard Justice Scalia mention. Then they start talking about voter fraud. So there have been different arguments made against the Voting Rights Act, but I think we have to realize that the current effort to restrict voting rights doesn't just come out of nowhere, that the groundwork for this has been laid in the 60s, 70s, 80s, and 90s and early 2000s by people that have never really liked the Voting Rights Act much to begin with.
Well, let's hear John Lewis actually echo what you've just said. Here he is speaking with MSNBC in 2013. This is Georgia Congressman John Lewis.
In the 11 states of the old Confederacy, and even in some of the states outside of the South, there have been a systematic, deliberate attempt to take us back to another period. And these men that voted to strip the Voting Rights Act of its power, they never had to pass a so-called literacy test. It took us almost 100 years to get where we are today. So will it take another 100 years to fix it?
So in the time that we have left, maybe you can tell me about the chances for the Voting Rights Advancement Act of 2015. Will that fix some of the problems you're talking about?
It would go a long way towards fixing the problem by restoring protections of the Voting Rights Act that the Supreme Court overturned based on more modern circumstances. So it updates the Voting Rights Act, but it also provides protection in those places where discrimination has historically occurred most often, including in Georgia. Now, this Congress, they're unlikely to restore the Voting Rights Act, but it's important to remember the last reauthorization of the Voting Rights Act passed just in 2006 by a vote of 390-33 in the House and 98-0 in the Senate, and it was signed by President George W. Bush. That was not that long ago.
But that was still pre-Barack Obama, and we've seen how polarized politics has become since 2008.
Well, absolutely, and I think it's unfortunate that voting rights have become so politicized, because one of the things I showed in my book is that there had always been very strong bipartisan support for the Voting Rights Act. This was something that was done by Democrats and Republicans, and it's only fairly recently that your support for voting rights tends to break down along partisan lines. And I think we have to get back to the notion that when more people participate, it's good for everybody, as opposed to trying to keep certain people out of the political process.
Ari Berman is a senior contributing writer for The Nation magazine and author of Give Us the Ballot. The world has never seen an era free of war, at least as far back as our history books go. Why is that? A new production at the Atlanta Opera asks the question, is peace possible? We'll explore that tomorrow, but I want to put the question to you as well. Could we ever actually see an end to war? Is world peace possible? Call us at 404-500-9457, and then be sure to join us Wednesday at 9 a.m. for more. At this point, we are 1 week away from the election, and an ABC poll shows Hillary Clinton 1 point ahead of Donald Trump with a 3-point margin of error. That phrase, margin of error, is one we hear a lot during election season. We hear it so much, we often don't even notice it anymore. And yet many people don't really understand what it is. And that means it's time to break it down. Break it down, baby, because I want y'all all to know. Let me break it down for you again. Break it down now. Break it down. In order to explain the margin of error, I first need to outline a few basic facts. We are talking about statistics here. Statistics is a specific kind of math.
In plain English, I concatenate diverse statistical information to maximize the potential utilization of data.
It's designed to take a huge amount of data and then interpret that data to draw conclusions. So if you've ever said something like, I drink about 2 cups of coffee every day, you have used statistics. The exact amount of coffee you drink on a daily basis over a period of months or years has been collected by your brain and then boiled down to an average, 2 cups a day.
Dude, I'd be a mess if I had to give up my Joe. I have a full-blown addiction.
People use statistics in business and sports and music and science in nearly every part of society. Statistics helps us learn from data, usually really large data sets. And that includes how people think they might vote in an election. The very first political poll we know of happened in 1824. It showed Andrew Jackson was way ahead of John Quincy Adams in the race for the presidency.
I see a new nation ready to take its place in the world. Not an empire, but a republic.
But that was a straw poll. That means it was informal. People just asked a group of people what they thought and then added up the results. That's called a straw poll after the practice among farmers of tossing a handful of straw into the air to see which way the wind is blowing. Straw polls are not very accurate. And it was the fantastic disaster of a straw poll in 1936 that led to the creation of the scientific poll that is used today. At the time, then-President Franklin Roosevelt faced a challenge from Alf Landon, the governor of Kansas.
Across the country, the cry is heard. Let's make it a Landon slide.
A magazine called Literary Digest had been conducting straw polls for almost 2 decades at that point. They would mail out ballots to all of their subscribers and then tally the results. The magazine had a huge mailing list.
It's not just big, it's huge!
The magazine sent out about 10 million ballots in 1936, but the pool of respondents was not very diverse. They tended to be wealthy, white, and Republican.
Why are you wearing a tux?
It's after 6. What am I, a farmer?
Literary Digest was the most respected poll in the U.S. It predicted Alf Landon would defeat Roosevelt easily with 57% of the popular vote. Now, since President Landon doesn't appear in the history books, we know that poll was very, very wrong. And one guy predicted that the Literary Digest would get it wrong, a young statistician named George Gallup.
Dr. Gallup celebrates the 25th anniversary of the Gallup poll. Over the years, he has won an international reputation for measuring the public's attitude on social, political, and economic issues of the day.
Gallup had created a new method for polling that was based on survey sampling. He polled a small number of people who represented a wide range of incomes and backgrounds. Gallup used to compare survey sampling to soup.
No soup for you!
You can only know the flavor of an entire soup if you mix it thoroughly and get a big enough mouthful. You can't just scoop up one vegetable and say the soup tastes like carrots. Based on the scientific polling of only 50,000 people in 1936, Gallup correctly predicted that Roosevelt would win, and Gallup's reputation was made. that reputation was marred about 12 years later. You know that famous photograph of Harry Truman holding up a newspaper with the headline, Dewey defeats Truman? Yeah, that was Gallup's fault.
I was way off.
But the problem wasn't his scientific method. It was that his organization was so sure of the results, they stopped polling more than 3 weeks before the election. Plenty of time for a whole bunch of people to change their minds.
Undecided voters considered the most coveted voting block. This year, roughly 1 in 9 Americans haven't made up their minds.
And since we're already talking about errors, let's finally get to the margin of error that started this whole explanation.
Finally!
The margin of error in a poll refers to the chance that the group you talk to actually represents the whole population. It represents the chance that the poll is wrong and the sample doesn't represent the wider nation. The larger your sample size, the lower the margin of error goes.
Sir, the possibility of successfully navigating an asteroid field is approximately 3,720 to 1.
Never tell me the odds.
So if you poll about 100 people, your margin of error is 10%. 100 people is not a lot, so there's a reasonable chance that they do not represent the 219 million eligible voters in the U.S. If you poll 2,400 people, the margin of error goes down to 2%.
Any questions?
Yes! Several!
The margin of error is the measure of how close that poll is to reality. But the margin of error can't take into account mistakes like Gallup made in 1948 when he predicted the victory of President Dewey. Any poll is just a snapshot. It's a scientific guess. And the margin of error tells us how accurate that guess is at that point in time.
Time makes us all a prisoner of the present, forever transitioning from our own past into an unknown future.
So those are the basics. Now let's get more specific information from an expert.
If I could turn back time, if I could find a way, I'd take back those words.
Here to tell us more is Andrew Mercer. He's a senior research methodologist at the Pew Research Center. Good morning, Andrew.
Good morning.
I got to ask you first if we got everything correct.
Yeah, for the most part, that's about right. Those are two really good examples that you raise in there. You know, the Literary Digest poll had a huge sample size. It would have had a very small margin of error, but that only works if you've got a random sample. And like you say, the Gallup example, it's only, the poll only represents what's true right now, and what's true now may not be true tomorrow.
And yet, one thing that occurs, Andrew, is that all of the polls that we see are not as good as the next, right? I mean, we see a lot of polls coming across, and people wonder, why are they so different? And that's because everyone doesn't use the same stringent methodology as everybody else, correct?
There's a lot of different ways people do it. It's not necessarily that some are better than others. I mean, some do tend to have, better characteristics than others. But even, minor changes like different question wordings can produce different results.
And also, I mean, one of the things that comes up all the time, and this is not reflected in, say, a margin of error, is the fact that polls have long relied on landlines, calling people on a regular phone, and that's problematic in the age of the cell phone. How problematic do you think it is?
Well, this has gotten a lot of attention. It is problematic if you're only calling landlines. But for instance, what we do at the Pew Research Center and what most major media organizations do is we actually call a mixture of landlines and cell phones. In fact, we call about 75% of the numbers that we call are cell phones. So this is actually a problem that has been addressed pretty well by the major people in the industry.
So then why do we hear people like Donald Trump and many of his surrogates saying that there are phony polls out there and that polls are not accurate? And then why do we see, as we did in the last election, some polls predicted a Romney victory, whereas Nate Silver was one of the few people who said it's not going to be close, and he ended up being correct. Why are polls so wrong so often?
Well, you know, the truth is people have looked into this, and they're not actually wrong as often as you'd think. One of the things that happens is that you hear about it when they're wrong, but you don't necessarily hear about all the times that you actually do get it close. You know, we pay attention to the things that are surprising, and so it's not always, it's not as bad as it looks or sounds like in the media.
So we have this ABC poll that I quoted earlier that shows Hillary Clinton 1 point ahead of Donald Trump, but a 3-point margin of error. And that means that, realistically speaking, Donald Trump could be ahead if it's within that margin of error.
Yeah, I mean, that is, you know, that is what the margin of error means, which is, you know, if you sort of repeated this same survey 100 times, you know, 95% of the time, it would be within 3% of the truth. So that's sort of the, yeah, the right understanding of what that implies.
My guest is Andrew Mercer of the Pew Research Center, and we're talking about the margin of error in polls. But here's the thing, Andrew, we were talking about how many people are polled, and there's hundreds of millions of eligible voters in the U.S. So how can you get to 95% or better accuracy if we only poll 1,200 or 2,000 of them?
Sure. So the way that works under the hood is if you know that there are, you know, 200 million voters and you know that you want a sample of 1,000 people, what statisticians can do is they actually know the number of possible samples of 1,000 people that you could get out of all of those people. And based on that, you can actually calculate these probabilities and understand and measure just how close you are likely to be to the true result.
So then how is that different than, say, the chance of winning? And I say that because, yes, as I may go back to that ABC poll, because it's one of the most recent, that shows Hillary Clinton ahead by only 1 point. And yet when you go to Nate Silver's blog, which a lot of people consult, he shows Clinton with an almost 76% chance of winning. What is the difference here?
Sure. Well, there's a couple things going on there. You know, one is that you know, the aggregators who combine a lot of different polls, they're also combining sort of state-level polls and a lot of different pieces of information, and they have a model that they use to make their predictions, and they're sort of trying to forecast a result based on a lot of different pieces of information. You know, one poll has a, you know, like you say, a margin of error, and it's doing something a little bit different, which is, you know, measuring what the electorate looks like right now. And, you know, there's a number of different kinds of error that
can go
into that.
I'm sorry, Andrew, what does that mean, measuring what the electorate looks like right now? What does that mean?
Sure. So, for instance, you know, if you get 1,000 voters on the phone and you ask them, you know, who would you vote for if the election were today, you know, what you're getting is who they support right now. And between now and next week, you know, things could change. People could change their minds. And then the other thing that comes up is people may intend to vote now, but they don't end up voting on election day, whether because something else came up or they just decided not to. But, you know, but there's a lot of reasons why what people say today may not actually perfectly reflect what happens on election day.
Which is how Gallup ended up with the Dewey defeats Truman headline.
Exactly right, yep.
But how much does that margin of error also include people not telling the truth? It has been found that sometimes people aren't honest about which candidate they support.
Yeah, that's exactly right. I mean, that's something that people like myself worry about quite a lot. In terms of who people support, that tends to be the kind of thing that people are honest about, but that is always always a worry. You know, it's not the margin of error that you hear about really only reflects error that comes because of sort of the random selection. So that's really it. It doesn't account for other kinds of error like people not telling the truth or certain kinds of people not responding to the survey.
All right. So at this point, how much can we rely on polls? And I ask that because in so many ways, this election is exceptional. And the electorate is in some ways exceptional. So are our polls in context different than they have been in presidential elections of the past?
Well, I mean, every presidential election is unique in some respect. You know, I guess we'll find out in a week. The hardest thing, I think, for pollsters is trying to understand who's going to vote. And there's really just no – people have a lot of different ways of doing that. But it's a really hard thing to do, and I think that's sort of the biggest challenge.
And to what extent, Andrew, do polls influence votes? And by that I mean, let's say that you're a Trump supporter, but you, in the end, weren't going to go out and vote for whatever your reason may be. But then you see the chance that he may lose, and does that actually motivate? Do polls motivate people to either go to the polls or stay home?
You know, it could. I mean, that makes sense. This is a really hard thing to actually study because, you know, you can't really do an experiment where you expose some people to polls and other people to no polls and then see how they behave. So it's not something that I think people have a really good understanding of.
So what do we still have? Andrew, do you think our polls are fully accurate right now? Or are there more things that we need to tweak?
You know, I think on the whole, polls are good. You know, there's the population is always changing, society is always changing, and polls, you know, need to keep up with that. And so we always need to try to, you know, improve our methods to stay, you know, stay up to date. But, you know, I think by and large, that's what people are trying to do.
Andrew Mercer is a senior research methodologist at the Pew Research Center, probably reading a lot of polls and polling a lot of people. Thank you so much, Andrew.
Thank you.